We are holding on Kofiut Gimel on the day, the second line from the bottom. Now, we learned in the Mishnah about various cases involving a cheresh and a chereshes, involving whether they're allowed to stay married, not allowed to, cases involving yibum, where the wife becomes also to her husband because of chayt chalutzasa, or various other cases. So first, the Gemara is going to get into a whole discussion over here, a whole sugya on the
Okay, we'll
get to it as we go through. But first, the Gemara is going to go through into a more general question like this. A cheresh, then, as a deaf mute, is somebody who in halacha is considered they have diminished mental capacity. On the face of it, the Gemara is going to discuss over here the question, what about a katan, a child, is similar, they also don't have full mental capacity, and as the Gemara is going to discuss over here, we say that a katan who is doing something which is aser, you don't necessarily have to prevent him from doing it, which we'll get as we go through the sugya, we'll see how that works out in practical halacha. And then we'll eventually relate it to our Mishnah.
Why do you say that? Why can't you say that?
Well, that's the definition of a deaf mute. Means basically, usually the usual meaning of it is that they're congenitally they were born without the ability to hear, and in those days they didn't have the ability to teach them sign language or lip reading or what have you. So therefore, the person is unable to communicate with the outside world, and therefore they can't develop full mental capacity. We discussed yesterday, actually, the Gemara discussed the question: is it that they have an incomplete mental capacity, but they're always on the same level, or is it that sometimes they're better off and sometimes worse off? Anyway, so I'm going to start off with a case like this. Rabbi Yitzchak bar Bisna irkusu lo maftechei debei medrusha b'shus harabim b'shabsa. Rabbi Yitzchak bar Bisna lost the keys to the Bes Medrash in the Rishus Harabim in the street on Shabbos. All right, I'll go to Kabbalah, takes out the word B'Shabbos because he couldn't have been carrying them on Shabbos, but all right, you could say maybe it was on Shabbos. He was wearing a Shabbos key belt and it broke. Whatever, anyway. The point is the keys got lost in the street. It's Shabbos. They need to open up the Bes Medrash. What are they going to do? Also, the Kamei did a Pedos, so he comes to the Pedos to ask him what to do. Amalei, and the Pedos tells him, Zil Dvar Tali Vitalia, go bring a little boy and a little girl, or maybe more than one. Rashi just said, Tinoikos is Chorim and Akevis, children, boys and girls, so maybe like a whole bunch of children, Vilitai Luhasim, and let them play there in the street. De'im Mashkechi Luhu, and that way, if they find the keys, Maisi Luhu, they can bring them. Their kids, if they carry in Rosh Hasarabim, it's not going to be a big deal. Right. Alma Kasava, which goes to show that Rav Pedos holds, Katan Oichel Nevelis, that for example, if a child is eating Nevela, meaning Treif, or doing any other Aveira, like in this case, carrying in the street on Shabbos, ain't based in Mitzvah Lafrisha, then based in does not have a specific mitzvah to prevent him from doing that. Now, the Rishonim and the Rishonim talk about extensively, how does all this fit? We're going to go through now various details that the Gemara is going to go through, but among them, I mean, isn't there a concept of chinuch? Don't we, you know, isn't there that a father has a mitzvah to be mechanech his children? So that's one answer, is that the Gemara is talking about here about Beis Din, as opposed to the father, yes, has a mitzvah to be mechanech his children, meaning to prevent them from doing Nisurim. Another way of looking at it is that there are actually Rishonim who say that no, a father has a mitzvah to be mechanech his children in positive mitzvahs, but not necessarily to prevent them from doing Averis, like in this case, carrying in the street on Shabbos. Also, the Gemara is going to point out in a minute that there's a difference between things Daraisa and Darabah. But the major difference that I'm talking about, the difference that the Beis Din versus the child's father. The child's father does indeed have a mitzvah of chinuch. So the Gemara says, Lema Messiah Le, can we say that the following Braisa supports him? That we're saying that you're allowed, that you can have a child do a malacha for you on Shabbos. A Braisa says, Lo yoma adam latinek chavili mafteach chavili choisem. You can't tell a child on Shabbos, bring me a key or bring me a seal. But you can allow him you can't tell him to do it, in other words, but you can allow him on his own if he wants to pick something, presumably from the ground, which would be malacha daraisa, or manichai zorek, you can allow him to throw something in the street, again, which on the face of it is a malacha. So there you see exactly that point, that you can have a cut and do a malacha daraisa. The answer is Amar Abaye, not necessarily, because you could say tolish ba'atzit she'en enakru, because you could say that when the Braita talks about pulling something out, it means, for example, from a flower pot that does not have a hole, rare midaraisa, there wouldn't be a problem picking anything from it on Shabbos anyhow, the whole problem is only midrabanan. And similarly, zodik b'kamelist d'rabanan, the case of him throwing could involve where he's throwing something at a kamelist, where the whole is there carrying over there is only midrabanan anyway. Midaraisa a karmelis is midaraisa. What the rabbanon call a karmelis would either be a rishus yachid or a makom patur, an exempt area. So far the Gemara has established one point, which is that there's a difference between things daraisa and things the rabbanon. What? There's four rishuyas. Rishus rabim, which is public domain, rishus yachid, a private domain, karmelis, which is sort of an in-between kind of thing, and makom patur, an exempt area. A karmelis, the concept of not being able to carry, and a karmelis is only d'rabanan. So therefore, what we're saying, so far the Gemara has established one fact, that there's not a problem if a katan is doing something that's only also d'rabanan, you don't necessarily have to stop him. Again, according to the Rambam, that would only be that the Beis Din, the local Beis Din, or other people in town don't have a mitzvah to stop him, but his father does have a mitzvah to be mechanech him, including in Dinim D'Rabbanan. Tashma, come, let's bring another proof. A Mishnah says in Shabbos, Ovid Gechavim Shabbalah Chabos, if a fire breaks out on Shabbos, and a goy comes to put out the fire, Ein Omrim like Kabe, you can't tell him to put out the fire, because you don't have to tell a goy to do malacha for you on Shabbos. But Ba'altachaba, you don't have to tell them on Shabbos, don't put it out. Because you're not responsible for making sure that a guy doesn't do malacha on Shabbos. We're not talking about if lives are in danger. If lives are in danger, that's a whole other matter. Then even Jews can put out the fire. We're talking about where only property is in danger. But the Mishnah continues, but if a child comes to put out the fire, then we do tell him, don't put it out. Because you are responsible for making sure you have to keep Shabbos. So what are you telling me then that in the case over here with the lost keys, you can have kids carry them in Rosh Hashanah? When we see over there, you can't have kids put out a fire on Shabbos. And the difference is at Mishnah is talking about where the child is doing it with the consent of his father. Rashi says he's looking at his father. He sees that his father is standing there, and his father approves of it. So that's the equivalent of the father telling him to do it. In the case of the keys, the father's not standing there. Nobody's told the kids that the keys are lost. They just brought them here. There's a nice place for you to play, and they're in the street over here. And they're going to find the keys on their own. Which gives us, therefore, item number two, which is that if the child is doing it with your consent, then that's another matter. And then that's also, because after all, the Torah says, it's in the Aseret HaDibros, that where you have to keep Shabbos, Ata Uvincha Uvitecha, you, your son, and your daughter. The Gemara asks, wait a minute, the Kavah say, Gavah Ered Gechavim, Da'i Saldas Yisrael Mishari. So what, then the parallel thing would be then, what are you talking about, that the Goy is also doing it with the Jews' approval? How is that allowed? You can't have a Goy doing Malacha for you with your approval either. Effectively, the goy is in that case. The goy effectively would be acting as your shliach. The same way as you can't have a goy, you can't tell a goy to do malacha for you. If you're standing there and approving what he's doing, isn't that the same thing? And the answer is no. Or even kachav madaita dinafshe of it. No, because the goy is actually doing it on his own understanding. Even if you don't tell him, because Rashi says he knows that he's going to get paid for it. He knows that after Shabbos you'll pay him for having put out the fire. So therefore, even if he says so whether you're there or not, he still has a vested interest in doing it. By the way, this kind of thing comes up, you know, nowadays. Yeah, it's a very very common situation that you have, you know, a light is on or off on Shabbos by mistake, or the air conditioner is on or off or whatever, and you know, people will take a little, you know, people will take the little kid and bring him over there to turn the light on or off. You see people doing it. It based on this Gemara, it gets into a bit of a question whether that's allowed. So one detail is, we did say just right here at the beginning that when it's an Issur D'Rabbanan, there's not such an issue. And the Alter Rebbe holds in particular that even the child's parents, it's not, they don't have to, they should prevent him from doing an Issur D'Rabbanan, but not when he's so young that he doesn't know the difference, which is the age that we're talking about. So if it's an Issur D'Rabbanan, there's much less of an issue. If it's an Issur D'Oraisa, then you have a bit more of an issue, One thing is maybe you can't bring the child there, the Gemara is going to talk about later, you can't actually give him the issur to do, but if he's playing around over there and then happens to turn on or off the light, then you don't necessarily have to stop him.
Pick him up to the light.
To pick him up to the light might be suffered. Like, yeah, that might be an issue. No, that's what we're talking about. Sometimes it can be a deraita, sometimes it can be a derabana.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So we're saying if it's an issue derabanan, then according to the Alter Rebbe, it's not such a big deal. But if it's an issue deraita, like turning on or off a light, which according to most poskim is also deraita, then you might have a problem. If the child turns it on or off themselves, fine. But if you lift them up, for example, to it, then you might have an issue. But again, there is also the consideration that the child is too young to realize the difference. There's more of an issue if the child is old enough to understand about Shabbos.
Yeah, but
close
enough to this year.
Yeah. Tashma, come, let's bring another proof. A Braisa says, Ben Chaver Shrogel Leilach Eitzel Avim, Amaret. If you have the son of a Chaver is somebody who, in particular, is careful on the dinim of Truma and Maiser. So the opposite of it is an Amaret, who the Amaret in those days were careful about Truma, but not so careful about Maiser. So you have the son of a Chaver, Shrogel Leilach Eitzel Avim, Amaret. He's accustomed to going to visit his grandfather, who is an Amaret. You don't have to worry that the grandfather is going to give his grandchild food that has not been meisered. And even when the kid comes back home, if you find food in his hand, you don't have to do anything about it. You don't have to take away the food from him and take meiser from it. So, now, on the face of it, so we see then that the child is able to do an issur. He's eating fruit that truma and maaser might not have been that maaser might not have been taken from. That's tevel, and you're still allowing it. So there, again, that proves the point. The same way as with the keys, that you can have the child do something which is also. Rabbi Yochanan b'dmai hekilu. So Rabbi Yochanan says by dmai they're mekel because the whole concept of dmai only existed. Abanon midaraisa, we say since most amei aretz do take maaser, we can assume that it was taken. It's only midrabanon we have the whole concept of dmai. Therefore, it's not such an issue. Tosfos points out we already established that rabanon is not an issue. So what's this answer about dmai adding? And the answer is two things. Number one, first of all, just the Gemara often throughout Shas uses b'dmai hekilu as a standard answer that dmai is more lenient than many other dinim because it's only midrabanon. Number two, there's a difference between before we were talking about, for example, something which the action itself is definitely derabanan. Carrying an akarmelis, for example, there's no question. It's not also deraisa. It's only also derabanan. Dmai over here, the whole point is, why is it also derabanan? Because maisa might not have been taken. It might be tevel deraisa. Yet Rabbi Yochanan is saying that when it comes to dmai, we're able to be mekel. So it's not just when something is definitely derabanan, but even when we're not sure, when it's also derabanan because of a suffix minatora, nevertheless we still allow it. But again, that doesn't prove anything about the child being able to do a malacha deraisa, like in the case of the keys. So we're still trying to prove that. Question is, elatayma de dmai havada ba'olasuri. So what are you telling me? Why are you allowing the child to continue eating the fruit only because it's dmai, but implying that if you knew for sure that maaser hadn't been taken, you would have to take it away from him and take maaser? How could that be? We said before that Rabbi Yochanan said in the case of the fire that when do you have to prevent the child from putting out the fire? Only if he's doing it with his father's consent. He's not eating the fruit specifically with his father's consent. His grandfather gave it to him. His father has nothing to do with it. Ella said, no, the answer is Rabbi Yochanan Sapuki Masapkalei. Rabbi Yochanan actually has a doubt about this issue. Whether in fact it has to be that the father is actually watching and approving, or not. So in the case of the fire, Rabbi Yochanan says, we're talking about din deraisa. Maybe though the Mishnah is implying that it's mutter if the father is not standing there approving of it. On the other hand, in the case of the non-maisered fruit, Rabbi Yochanan is saying maybe it's not a question of the father approving or not. Maybe it's a question of demai versus vaday, a derabanan versus a deraisa. Because Rabbi Yochanan himself, in other words, is not sure about what the parameters of this issue is. what we allow and what we don't allow the child to do. Tashma, come, let's bring another proof from another case involving a chaver and an Am Haaretz. This time, though, we're talking about kohenim who eat truma. Now, truma has to be eaten in a state of tahara. The food itself has to be tahar, and the kohen has to be tahar. Am Haaretz, another set of dinim that they were often careless about, was the dinim of truma v'tahara. So ben chaver kohen shirogel leilach etzel avim a kohen Am Haaretz. So if you have the child of a kohen who is a chaver, who therefore they're careful to eat truma v'tahara, and he's accustomed to going and visiting his grandfather, who is also a kohen, but is an Am Haaretz. We're not worried that the grandfather is going to give him truma tmeya to eat. And matzah b'yadei peiros, and similar to the previous case, even if the kid comes back home holding fruit. It's a good question. The other one was also avi'imai. Maybe because, yeah, maybe a child tends to be closer with their mothers, with their grandfather on their mother's side. I don't know. Yeah. The problem is, maybe the grandfather gave him truma, which is tave, but we don't have to worry about it. So matzah b'yadei peiros ein zakuklai. Even if you find food in his hand, you don't have to worry about it. Now, here we got, now before, when it came to the question of d'mai, fine, you could say d'mai is only a problem, d'rabbanan, therefore we can be makel. Truma t'meya is an issur d'oraisa. So doesn't that prove that even if the child's doing an issur d'oraisa, you don't have to stop him? And again, the answer is b'truma d'rabbanan. We could be talking about over here about truma, which is only d'rabbanan. There's many different cases where truma is d'rabbanan. Among them are, according to Rashi, it's any, the truma of anything except for grain, grapes, and olives is d'rabbanan. But the Rambam disagrees with that. It could be it was grown in a flower pot with a hole that we talked about before. That's only chayiv and truma d'rabbanan. It could be that it grew outside Eretz Yisrael, where only in Eretz Yisrael is chayiv and atara. There are many possibilities, but whatever it is, given that it's only a truma d'rabbanan, you're back to the issue that it's only an issur d'rabbanan, and therefore, we could say, therefore, we'll allow the kid to eat it. Not necessarily. If it was truma d'oraisa and there was a problem with truma, would you allow him to? So you still don't have a proof.
How do you know that the Gemara's instruction is truma d'rabbanan? In other words, can we say
No, well, we're just saying we can't prove one way or the other. We're trying to prove with a pedophilic statement that you can have the kids go and play in the street and carry the keys, even though that would be a malacha d'oraisa. And so far, we haven't found a proof for that yet, because every proof we found could be talking about a special case.
And
that's when you say it was made. Right. Tashma, come, let's bring another proof. Braisa says, a baby can nurse from a goyish woman or from a treifa animal, where the milk is, where a goyish woman, technically, her milk is not osir. It's not recommended, it says in Shulchan Aruch, because it's metamtim alev v'amoyach. It has a ruchmiistic bad effect on the child, but it's not outright osir. And we know there was a famous thing where Moshe would nurse from a goyish woman, but that was an exceptional case. But mainly we're talking about over here about behemoth meyer, where the milk of a non-kosher animal is lahalacha, not kosher. But we're saying a baby can nurse from them. And we're not concerned about the issue that it's as if he's sucking on something disgusting, something which is osir. The expression yonik sheket, the Gemara discusses in Ksubas, the Gemara has a discussion over there about how long is a baby allowed to nurse for before it becomes also midrabanan, and the expression is that beyond a certain age it's kyonik sheket. It's like sucking on something repulsive, on a sheret or whatever. So in this case we're saying it's not an issue. Sheretz means basically various kinds of non-kosher creatures. Anyway, so we're saying it's not an issue, but the Braisa continues, you're not allowed to give the child to eat nevela or trefa or shkotzim or ramasim or little creepy crawly creatures that are treif, but the child can nurse from any of them, even on Shabbos, he can nurse milk from an animal, even though usually that would be the malacha of dosh, of threshing. But an adult is not allowed to do that on Shabbos. And the Braita continues, Abba Sholem, and Nogin Oyinu, Shiyonkim, and Behemet Torah, and Yomtiv. Abba Shol says, we used to suck milk from a kosher animal on Yomtiv. So not on Shabbos, but on Yomtiv, you're allowed to do certain malachas. And this is one of them. Katonimia in Choshishin Beyonek Sheket. So what are we saying? We're allowing the child to nurse from a treif animal, even though the milk is outright treif, and we're not worried about it. So therefore we see, and the milk of a treifa animal is also daraisa, just like the treifa animal itself, a camel or horse or whatnot, just like the meat of it is also minatoda, so is the milk of it. And we see you're allowing the child to nurse from it. The answer is, that's different. Hasam mishum sakana. There it's a different. There's different. If the kid doesn't nurse, he's going to die. He's going to die of hunger or thirst. They didn't have formula in those days. Question is, well, so then why is the Braisa, if it's just a matter of sakana, why is the Braisa making a distinction between a child or an adult? An adult who's in a dangerous situation where he's going to die of thirst is also allowed to nurse from a treif animal even on Shabbos because it's a matter of pikuach nefesh. The answer is, it's true, an adult could, but the difference is, gadol boy umdana. The difference is that with an adult, you can't just say a blanket statement that he can. You have to look at it. You have to look at the situation. Is he in a situation where he would be able to wait until after Shabbos, and then it will be mutter for him to do it? Not from a treif animal, but from a kosher animal. As opposed to with a baby. With a baby, you don't. With a baby, on the face of it, you don't. So that's the question. Katanami leboyum donna. Why don't we say the same thing with a baby? Why don't we evaluate and see, can the baby wait a couple hours till Shabbos is over? The answer is, Amar Avona b'Rei d'Rabbi Yeshua, stam tinik mesukan etzel cholov. Because the difference is, a regular child, when it comes to drinking milk, it's considered a danger to him if he doesn't have it right away. So yes, we can assume with a baby, a baby who's still nursing, that they need their milk supply right away. If the mother's not available, and all that's available is an animal to nurse from, then yes, you're going to have to. And if it's a treifa animal, so be it. If it's a treifa animal, if it's Shabbos, so be it, it's Shabbos. Because we assume, even without evaluating it, that it's going to be dangerous for the baby to do without it. As opposed to with an adult, it's true, an adult might be able to also, but you have to evaluate the situation first. No, this is the pashtus. They have other food too, yeah. So therefore, you still don't have a proof from there that you're allowed to. You still don't have a proof from there that you're allowed to have a child, or in this case, a baby, eat safe food, something that's safe midaraisa, and not have to stop them. Which we started out the discussion. Katan oichal nevelas ain't based in the tzuvim afrishoy. That if he's eating nevela, you don't have to stop him. Here on the face, we tried to prove it from this place, so we still haven't been able to prove it yet. Nevela means an animal that died on its own. It means tray for meat, basically. Forgot to mention, by the way, going back to the fire a second, Tosfos points out in Shabbos. Now we know, we learned in Shabbos, and we've learned a few times since then, that there's a major machloikas on the question, malacha shein etzricha legufa. If you're doing a malacha, not for the purpose, not for its usual purpose. The purpose that they did the malacha, putting out fires in the Mishkan, was to make charcoal. You're putting out a house fire over here, you're not doing it in order to make charcoal. Why would it be an issur d'oraisa anyway? On the face of it, it's only an issur d'rabbanan. And we established at the beginning of the sugya that that a child's doing an issur d'rabbanan, you don't have to stop him. The Tosfos gives two answers there in Shabbos. One is that we're talking according to Rabbi Yehuda, who holds that there's no difference, tzricha legufa or ain't tzricha legufa, either way you're chayev. Or it's also d'oraisa, or even according to Rabbi Shimon, yeah, you could have a case over here, you want to be able to use the charcoal that's resulting from it. You want to put out the fire so that all your stuff doesn't get burnt up, but also you want to be able to use the resulting charcoal. And then even Reb Shimon would agree that that's also. What? If that's the only way to understand this, I'll leave it to Hilchos, because the fact is the halacha is like Reb Shimon, then that's how we have to understand it. Okay, then the Braisa continued. Avashol oim anoygan yinu shayontim behemet tahor v'yomtov. That Avashol said that we used to suck milk from a kosher animal on yomtov. Question is heichidami. What kind of situation was it? E de'ika sakana. If it's a case where the person was in danger, after the b'shabbos nami, then you're allowed to do it even on Shabbos. Why on yomtov? V'idulecha sakana. After the yomtov also. And if there's no sakana, yes, you're allowed to do certain malachas on yomtov. But not things that's for one thing, not malachas that could have been done before Yom Tov. So why would you be allowed to do this on Yom Tov? What would be the difference between Shabbos and Yom Tov? The answer is loitzricha deikat saira. Okay, but you're talking about a case. It's not a matter of actual danger. It's not a matter of pikuach nefesh. But the person is having tsar. For example, the Gemara mentions in Ksubas there was a condition. The Gemara in Ksubas mentions a condition deneach, where a person is groaning from. I think I've seen an explanation that the person has like angina or something, like a chest pain or whatever. And the refuah for it in those days was that he should nurse from a, that he should nurse that he, they should suck milk from the from the teats of an animal, from the udder of an animal. So therefore, the kasover, sort of, avashol holds mefarik kal acha yadu. It's doing mefarik, which is a tolda, it's a subcategory of a malacha of dosh, but it's kal acha yadu. It's in an unusual way. Therefore, Shabbos dosh is threshing. Therefore, Shabbos to issur skila. So in the case of Shabbos, where the malacha of threshing is an issur daraisa, gazur rabbanan. So therefore, the rabbanan made exeder. Even you're doing it in an unusual way. Nevertheless, don't do it on Shabbos if it's just a matter of tzar. If it's a matter of sakana, that's different. Yom Tov to issur lav, whereas Yom Tov, there's no issur kares of malacha on Yom Tov. At worst, it's an issur lav. Therefore, like Bazir Be Rabbanan, therefore the Rabbanan did not make a Zera on doing the Malacha in an unusual way. In this case, where you're nursing directly from the animal's udder. Right? There's a lot. A loisa said that you're not allowed to do Malacha on Yom Tov.
You didn't mention he said something down here. No
care for directly. Where is it?
What?
Where is it?
But a shame told me.
Okay.
He knows the specific situation.
Okay.
The
one case where we said we're more strict with Yom Tov than with Shabbos, we learned in Beitza, is in the halachos of Mukta. Now, another machlokas, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, about Nolad, whether a type of Mukta called Nolad, like an egg that was laid on that day, is Mukta or not. And we learned that in the case of Yom Tov, we passed in like Rabbi Yehuda. But in general though, we're more lenient on Yom Tov. So this is one example of that. Getting back to the matter of whether we can have the child eating nevelos and not have to stop him. Toshma, the pasuk says, "Lo soichlum kishekatem." Don't eat these various creatures because they're disgusting. And the word "lo soichlum" can also be read as if it said "lo saachilum." Don't make others eat them. Which comes to teach us that the adults are told not to feed them to the children. Now, what does that mean? On the face of it, what does loisachilum mean? It sounds like it means the adults have a responsibility to tell the children, don't eat these. So that would mean, in other words, if the child's eating nevela or shrotim or whatever, you do have to stop them, which contradicts what we tried to say at the beginning. The answer is loy. No, not necessarily. The pasuk could mean you're not allowed to actually take the treifet food and give it to the child to eat. But if they pick it up on themselves and on their own and start eating it, maybe you don't necessarily have to stop them. Who says it's in your house? They're out and about on the streets, you know. Tashma, come, let's bring another proof. The pasuk says, "Kol nefesh mekem lo tzeich adam." Any person among you is not allowed to eat blood. Again, now there's many psukim that say you're not allowed to eat blood, and in Parashas Re'eh alone you have three psukim almost back to back that say it. So here you have an extra pasuk for it. So therefore, again, we learn that it's an extra pasuk to teach us that the adults have to tell the children not to. Again, on the face of it, doesn't that mean the adults have to tell the children don't eat blood? And again, the answer is no, not necessarily. It could just mean that they're not allowed to actually give it to them. So we can establish from these psukim so far that you're not allowed to actually give a child something today to eat. But if they found it on their own, not necessarily do you have to stop them. And again, we said before that there's a difference that Amnon makes a distinction in that between the father and everybody else. The father has a mitzvah of chinuch on his children, so therefore he does have to stop them. Tashma, Emor v'amarta, the pasuk says that the Eishah tells Moshe to tell Aaron and you should about the that Kohenim are not allowed to become tamei mes. And you should say, and again, the extra word v'amarta, la'azuk do'el malaktanim, comes to teach us that the adults have to tell the children. Again, my lavda amalu loy to tamu, doesn't that mean that the adults have to tell the children, don't become tamu? And again, the answer is no, it could mean that the pasuk is saying the adults are not allowed to go and make the children, koyanim, who are children, become tame. But again, if the child himself wanders into a cemetery, not necessarily do you have to prevent him. And the Gemara points out, we just had three dinim, the shrotim, blood, and tumah, where the Torah has to repeat each time something from which we learn that the adults have an obligation to tell the children not to. We need all three of them. The Iyashmin and Shkatsim, because if the Torah had only told us about Shkatsim, by insects, you would say, you know why, in that case, the Isser even exists on children, Mishum de Isser and Mamashu, because the Isser of Shkatsim, of insects, not insects really, but little creatures, the Torah lists eight of them, a mouse, a toad, a weasel, whatever, Mishum de Isser and Mamashu, the Isser of them applies to a much smaller amount. What does that mean? Rashi says it means the Isser of them would be with most Isserim, with most things in the Torah that are Osir, the Shear is a Kazayas. If you eat less than a Kazayas, you're not Chayim in a Torah. With the cake, with Shrotzim, it would be a smaller amount. It would be the size of a lentil, the same amount as could make you Tomei. It's also Osir to eat. Tosfos argues on that. Tosfos points out that even with Shrotzim, the Isser is with a Kazayas, same as everything else. The difference is that with shrotzim, and here we're talking also, for example, little insects like ants, for example, you'd be chayiv min atorda for eating even one little ant, even though it's much less than a kazayis. That's what we mean by mashu, that the shear for violating the mitzvah min atorda and getting malchus, an adult getting malchus for eating bugs, is even if it's much less than a kazayis. But when it comes to blood, where you need a revius, which is a larger amount, in order to be chayiv, emaloi, you would think maybe not. Maybe the Torah is more lenient on that. The iyashmein dam, conversely, if the Torah only told us by blood, you would say the difference is blood is more serious, mishum de ikakaris, because with blood, there's an isukaris. Shrotzim is only an isulav. Aval shrotzim emaloi. So maybe shrotzim would be more lenient. So you need those two. The Iyashmin and Hanitaki, then if the Torah had only told us by Dam and Shrotzim, you would say Mishum the Isur and Shavabakol, you know why those are more serious and why the din applies to children as well, because those mitzvahs apply to the whole Jewish people. Aval Truma Eim Aloi, but Truma only applies to Kayanim, so maybe not. Conversely, the Iyashmin and Truma, and if the Torah had only told us this concept that you have to tell the children, you have to not prevent the children, we said. You're not allowed to go and make the children become tamei. If it only said it by that, you would say koyanim shiny, you would say maybe the case, something that applies to koyanim is different. Mishum the river behind mitzvah yisaitis, because after all, the Torah gives many more extra mitzvahs to koyanim, so maybe this is another one. Avol hani emaloi, but when it comes to blood and shrotim, maybe not, maybe those are more lenient. Tzricha, so therefore we need all three psukim. So the Marsha points out that actually, on the face of it, the Gemara could have said that we still don't need all three of them. We could have had two of them, and we could have had two out of the three of them. We could have had Shrotzim and Tumas Mes, and we would understand from those also that it applies to other dinim as well. Okay, Marsha says just the Gemara didn't bother. The Gemara didn't bother with that. But actually, the Beis Yosef discusses it at some length. Because you have, on the one hand, the Rambam, who says that a father has to stop his children from doing Isurim because of the mitzvah of chinuch, whereas the Torah says not. The Torah says even if it's an Isur daraita, you don't necessarily have to stop him. So the Beis Yosef explains that they're basing themselves on two different ways of understanding our Gemara. We're saying there's three different mitzvahs that this applies to. Are we saying that the Torah didn't really need to write all three of them? It could have written only two of them, and we could have derived the other one. Then, if the Torah is specifically writing all three of them, then it means that the Torah is saying it only applies to those three cases, nothing else. Therefore, other Isurim, you don't have to prevent children from doing them, even if they're Isurim Daraita. That's the Torah's position. Whereas the Rambam would hold that since the Gemara is saying you need all three of them, you can't derive one from the other. So therefore, it's meant as a paradigm for everything else. It's meant as a binyanah for everywhere else in the Torah, and therefore it applies to other Isurim Shabbat Torah also. In, we're talking about when they're so that's another thing. Are we talking about even little kids? Before we were talking about nursing children, for example, which means really young, or are we talking about only when they're the age of chinuch for a particular mitzvah? Like for example, in the case of Shabbos, when they begin understanding what Shabbos is and what malacha is. There's by the way, there's a couple of letters and a couple of sichas from the Rebbe discussing this idea. There's a sicha in Chelek Beis and another one in Chelek Zayin. Why indeed did the Torah pick these three mitzvahs to teach us this idea? Lahazik Zolam Artanim. So in a sicha in Chelek Beis, the Rebbe explains that it's a lesson for us in chinuch. You have dam is something that the Rashi mentions in Parshas Re. The Jewish people were very used to eating it. You might think something that a kid is very used to doing, you're never going to be able to educate him out of it. You might as well not bother. No, the Torah tells us you have to educate him not to. Shrutim is something only really low down people would eat them, with bugs and things like that, like uncivilized.
Or fancy chef.
Yeah, only like really uncivilized people. So you might think somebody's on such a low level, you're not going to be able to get through to him. No, the Torah is saying you have to try to get through to him. Tumah is something which is l'mayla mitam adap. It's not based on logic. You would think, well, okay, you can be mechanech a kid in things that depend on logic, the mitzvahs that are logical, the mitzvahs that are illogical, that we don't understand how you're possibly going to be mechanech. No, the Torah is telling us l'hazik d'olam al-tanim. Chinuch applies to those areas of life, those areas of Torah as well. That's in Chelek Beis. And Chelek Zayin, the Rebbe gives a different angle on it, which is that you have, in every mitzvah you can talk about, there's the person, there's the person, there's the object, and there's the combination of the two, the person doing the iser. So Tumah represents, so the Tumas Kayanim represents the angle of the person. It's a special mitzvah on Kayanim. Shratzim represents the object, which is Aser. And Dam, we were saying, Yechayev Kares, for eating it, represents the combination of those two things together. So in things that apply to the person, things that apply to the object, and things that apply to both of them, I mean, all of those things, lahazir, that I've explained, lahazir, comes from the word zoya, which means shining. You have to make lahazir gdol ma'atanim, the greater parts of you have to illuminate the lesser parts of you to stick to these mitzvahs, to work on them. Okay, so now having gone through all of this discussion, now we're ready to connect it with our Mishnah. Tashma. We said in our Mishnah, Shnei Achin, he had two brothers, Echad Pekeach ve'Echad Cheresh. One was normal and one was a Cheresh, a deaf mute. Nesuin Shnei Achayis Pichos, and they're married to two normal women. Mesh Cheresh Bal Pitachas. We said if the deaf mute who's married to the regular to the normal woman died, Ma Yasa Pekeach Bal Pitachas. And what does the normal brother do? Well, simple. Teitz Mishum Achayis Isha. The Cheresh's wife is Potter from Chalitza and Yibum because she's the sister of his wife, who was an Erva. So no problem. On the other hand, mes pikeach bal pikachas ma yasa cheresh bal pikachas. What happens the other way around? The pikeach dies. What does the cheresh do as far as chalitza or yibum? Moitzias ishte beget. We say he has to divorce his wife with a get, which he's able to do because he married her on the drabanan level. He being a cheresh, he married her drabanan, so he's able to divorce her on the drabanan level too. A cheresh of the deaf mute. The Ashes Achim Asur Aloylam, and was saying that his wife's brother remains Asur forever because he's not able to do Chalitza with her. So what we wind up with, his own wife becomes Asur to him because she is the wife of his Skuka, the wife of the Pekeach who died, was married to him Daraisa, therefore the Zika exists Daraisa as well. The zikah, the connection between the fact that the yavama, the fact that the sister-in-law has to either marry her brother-in-law in Yibum or do the ceremony of chalitza. So she's his skuka. His wife is a chos skuka, which is also the rabbanim, and therefore we're saying he has to divorce her. And the yavama herself remains also because he's not able to do Yibum because she's the wife of his grusha, she's the wife of his divorcee, not the wife, the sister of his divorcee. And he can't do chalitza because he being a cheresh, he can't do chalitza. The question is, am I motzias ishta beget? Based on everything we just said, now that we just established that with a katan who's doing an iser, we don't have to prevent him from doing it, a cheresh is on the same level as a katan, presumably, because both of them have a lack of full intelligence, a lack of full das. Why do we force him to divorce his wife? Tesev gabe, let her stay by him. It's a case of katan oichon the velasu. It's a case of a katan who's doing an aveira. Yes, she's also to him the rabbanon, but so what? We established at the beginning of the sugya that if a katan is doing an issur the rabbanon, we don't have to stop him. So why should we have to stop him? Why should we force him to divorce her? The answer is mishum nisur v'dida. True, he himself, there might not be an issue, but she has an issur to be married to him. In every marriage that's also, you have the two partners. Even if the one of them is considered is a cheresh who doesn't have the capability to be usher, but the other one does have the capability. Tashma, the Gemara says, okay, come, let's consider the next part of the Mishnah. Shnei achin pitchin nesuin shtei achoyes achas b'kachas v'achas cheresh. It's the other way around. Now the two brothers are normal. The two sisters, the two wives are sisters. One's normal and one's a cheresh. So if the husband of the cherishes dies, what does the pekeach do? No problem. This cherishes is free to marry whoever she wants because she's his wife's sister. On the other hand, if the pekeach who's married to the pekeachas died, what does the husband of the cherishes do? Same idea. He has to divorce his wife for the get. In this case, he being a pekeach, he's able to be matir his brother's wife. He's able to do chalitza with her. Again, the question is, why should he have to divorce his wife for the get? Taste of Gabe, she should be able to stay married to him because Katan Eichon Nevelasu. Yes, you're saying that it's a marriage which is also to her because she is the sister of his chalutza, or the sister of his kukka, and later on the sister of his chalutza, but so what? It's not a problem. She's a Katan Eichon Nevelas. She's a Katan who's doing an Isser, and you don't have to stop it. And the answer is the opposite of the previous one, Mishumi Surah Day. True, but he is also to stay married to her. He's a Pekeach. He's fully Chayev and Mitzvah. What? Pekeach means a normal person, a non-cheresh, a non-deaf mute. Amar Rava Toshma. Okay, but come, let's bring a proof from the next part of the Mishnah. Shnei achin echad cheresh v'echad pekeach. If you have two brothers, one's a cheresh, one's normal. Nesuin the shtei achoyes achas pekachas v'achas cheresh. They're married to two sisters, one's normal, one's a cheresh. The normal one, the pekeach is married to the pekachas, the cheresh is married to the cheresh. So if the cheresh who's married to the cheresh dies, what does the pekeach do? No problem. The yivama is potter because she's his wife's sister. On the other hand, if the pekeach dies, what does the cheresh do? Again, moti has ish to be get. He has to divorce his wife, the cheresh, with a get because his wife is also to him the rabbanon as achoyz skukasay, the sister of his skukah. The Eishes Ochav Asur Alaylam, and the brother's wife remains also forever, because again, he can't marry her as long as his wife is alive, because that's actually forever, because she's a Choyskur Shasai, she's the wife of his divorcee, and once she was also to him temporarily for a while, for Yibum, then she remains also forever. He can't do Chalitza, because he's a Cheresh, he doesn't have the capability to do Chalitza. V'haha, now in this case, remember, the case was, it was a Cheresh married to a Cheresh. Both of them have a lack of Das. In this case, neither of them has an issur. Both of them effectively are like tanim. And you're still saying that he has to divorce his wife for the get. Why? Even if they stay married, why? That's a katan oich on the velus. And we established that a katan oich on the velus, midrabanan, then there's no issue with it. The answer is Amar Shmaya, Zera Mishmat Taras Yivam Alashuk. True, but if you allow the Cheresh to stay married to her husband, the Cheresh, people are not going to realize that the reason why we're allowing it in this case is because they're Cheresh and they don't have full capabilities. People are going to think that the Skuka herself is mutter to marry anybody she wants, and she's not. The zik on her daraisa, which can never be fulfilled. Unless the cheresh is cured of his disability, because of that, we don't want people to think or her herself to think that she's allowed to marry whoever she wants, that she became potter as a chos ishtoi when she's not, because the cheresh is only married to his wife, the cheresh is drabanon, whereas the zika exists deraisa. Because of that, zika is the connection, the fact that the requirement in the yivama to do chalitza or yivam. So because of that, Because of that, we want the cheresh to divorce his wife in order that it'll be clear to people that now we know she's also to him as a chos grusha, say as the sister of his grusha. And since chalitza can be done, then we'll realize that since chalitza can't be done because he's a cheresh, then we'll realize that everybody will realize that she's also. There won't be any possible confusion. Hadron al cheresh. So in the end, by the way, the Gemara has kind of left the question open: what is the deal with a katan oichel nevelus? When we have to stop him and when not? So this is why you have the various opinions of the Rishonim and Achronim on the subject. You have the Rambam's shita that the father has to stop him, but nobody else does. You have the Torah's shita that even the father doesn't have to stop him, even with an Issur D'oraisa. You have the Alter Rebbe's point in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Shin Mem Gimel. That if it's an Issur D'Rabbanon, as we said at the beginning of the sugya, even his father should stop him, but we don't require him to. And then there's all kinds of other permutations. There's cases where we say we don't want to allow a child to do something, which is also because we don't want him to get used to doing it when he's older as well. If there's a bris on Yom Kippur, for example, you don't have the kid drink the wine even though he's below bar mitzvah age and he should be allowed to, because you don't want him to get used to doing that kind of thing when he gets older. We learned earlier in the Masechta, in the ninth or tenth perek, we had various cases about the tenth perek Oisha. We had various cases where a woman's husband is missing. One aid came, two aidim came, or whatever, and we allowed her to remarry. So now we're taking that topic back up. When a woman's husband is missing, when we allow and don't allow her to marry, but now we're going to be focusing, at least at the beginning, more on she herself is saying. There's no edim, she herself is coming and saying that my husband is dead. Do we accept that or not? Now, we learned earlier when we had the previous perek about it, we said that there's two reasons why to be matir it. One was that people milta David la gluya, something that eventually the truth is going to be found out. People don't lie about. In this case, if she says that her husband is dead and he's really not, and he shows up, then she's exposed as a liar. Daiko mitzvah was the other thing. The second idea was isha daiko mitzvah, because since we learned previously that if a woman remarries and then her husband shows up, there's all kinds of penalties we put on her. She loses uksuba, and she's alter to both husbands, and her children from both marriages are mamzerim, and so on and so forth. So therefore, daiko mitzvah. Therefore, she's going to be very careful to make sure that her husband really is dead before she goes and remarries. So as we go through the parish, we'll discuss both of those considerations and see how they apply. But the point is, we assume that not. We assume, given that the penalties are so severe, she's not going to want to take her chances with them. But we're going to see in the Gemara over here, it's not necessarily always the case. Sometimes, yeah. We talked about it before, though. It was a knas, it was a penalty on her. Yeah. Okay. So the Mishnah starts off. Ha'isha shaholcha hi uvaila l'mdinas hayam, a woman where she and her husband went overseas. Shalom bein of the bein of a shalom ba'olam. They were at peace, so there's no reason to think that now when she comes and reports that he's dead, that she's doing it to try and get away from out of a bad marriage. The shalom ba'olam, and there was peace in the world, so there's no reason to suspect that he might have been killed in a war or something. And she comes and says, my husband died. No problem. Tinase, we'll allow her to remarry because given that everything was at peace, she won't say that he's dead unless she knows for a fact he's dead. Unlike the Mishnah is going to talk about, for example, if it's in a time of war or other upheavals like that, she might think he was dead. He might have been in a situation where she thinks he might have died and she's not 100% sure. But if it's a time of peace, then there's no reason to worry about that. Similarly, mes vayli tisyabim, or if she says my husband has died and we didn't have children, then she can do yibum. On the other hand, shalom beinu lebeinu melchama ba'olam, but if the two of them were at peace, but there's war in the world, there's war where they went, or k'tata beinu lebeinu v'shalom ba'olam, or there's arguments between them, so therefore we have to suspect that maybe she's trying to get out of a bad marriage, v'shalom ba'olam, but there's peace in the world, and how much more so obviously both, if they're fighting and the world is at war, or b'basav amar mesbali, and she comes and says, my husband has died, ain't an amen, we don't believe her. Because in the case where the two of them are fighting, maybe she's just trying to get out of a bad marriage, and she's willing, like you said, Yaakov, you know, she's willing to take her chances with all the consequences, as at least she's getting out of her current bad marriage. And in the case where there's war in the world, it might be, for example, let's say that her husband is missing for a couple of months or whatever, and she figures, you know what, he probably got killed in the crossfire or whatever, and really he actually survived. Rabbi Yehuda Omer La'olam Einan Emenes Elim Ken Basa Boichov Gadeh Kruin. Rabbi Yehuda says we never believe her, even if it's shalom between them and shalom in the world, unless she comes back crying and with her clothes torn. Where then, if she's doing that, you know for sure it means her husband's dead. Amr Eloi, the Chum told him no. Achasu v'achasu tinasi. Either way, whether she's crying and her clothes are torn or not, either way, if it's shalom between them and shalom in the world, she's fine. She can remarry. So Ingmar starts by pointing out. Tana shalom beina lebeina, mishum de kaboy la misnik tata beina lebeina. The Tana of the Mishnah starts off mentioning the idea that there's peace between them, as opposed to, because later on, the next part of the Mishnah talks about the case where they're fighting. Tana shalom ba'olam, and similarly, the Tana has to mention that there's peace in the world, mishum de kaboy la misnik milchama ba'olam, as for parallelism, because he's going to have to mention soon the case where there's milchama in the world. The point is, Tosfos says, the point that the Gemara is making with this line is, why did the mission have to start saying shalom bein lebein of shalom ba'olam? Let's say we didn't know for sure that they're at shalom. Let's say we didn't know for sure there's shalom in the world. Shouldn't we assume that a couple is usually at shalom? Shouldn't we assume there's shalom in the world unless we heard otherwise? That's the point. The Mishnah didn't really have to say that, but because the Mishnah is later on going to have to talk about where we know that they were arguing and we know that there was a war, therefore for parallelism it mentions shalom bein lebein, even though it's true, even if we didn't know for sure, we could assume it. Amar Rava, my time of Jamochama, what is the reason why if there was war going on, why we don't believe her to say her husband's dead? Mishum de Amra bididum. Because she may not be saying for sure he's dead, she may be assuming. Didami literally means something similar. So she didn't literally see him dead, but she figures, you know, people are getting killed all over the place over here in the crossfire. My husband's missing. He probably got killed also. Sakadaita, she figures, Cholhani de Ikto, who call it. She figures that, what, there's a whole bunch of people getting killed, how could he possibly have escaped? But she doesn't have solid proof of it. So therefore, we can't accept that. And you're going to say, Im Tim Tzolay Makibin to Shalom Bein or Lebein or Natra Ad Bechazia. So you might say, okay, well, that's fine. I can understand if she's upset with him anyway. She's not going to bother. But if they're at peace, wouldn't she want to stick around to make sure that he's really dead? The answer is no. Zimna de machol abugira oibiroimcha. She might be afraid to stick around because she might get caught in the crossfire. She might get hit with an arrow or a spear. So therefore, if it's a situation of war and she has reason to believe that her husband's dead, she's going to try to get out of there as fast as possible. And therefore, we can't necessarily assume that her husband really is dead. She might be assuming, and the assumption might be wrong. They might have hit him, but the point is that she also, right, Tosfos says, v'hi yirei lama, that she almost, she's afraid to stick, right, machulei, they hit him, so he was hit with an arrow, but she's afraid to stick around because she doesn't want to get hit with another arrow as well. Yeah. The savra v'ademes, so she figures he's for sure dead. But not necessarily, because even if he was actually hit with an arrow, the ikka da'avid samteri b'chaya, it's possible somebody might have treated him with samteri. Rashi just says over here that samteri means a dressing. In various other places, the Gemara describes samteri as a type of grass that has the capability of healing wounds, of closing up torn flesh. So somebody might have treated him with that, b'chaya, and then he survived after all. And meanwhile, she ran away for fear that she's going to get killed. And then he's alive, and she doesn't know about it. So that's why we don't believe her in the case of warfare. Now, Sava Rava Lameima. So Rava at first thought, okay, Rava and Ena Kimochama. What about if it wasn't a case of war, but there was a famine going on? That shouldn't be like war. Deloy Omer B'Dami, on the face of it. She's not going to say he's dead just by assumption. There's a famine. There's no reason for her to be running away. We should assume that she stuck around to know for sure that he's dead. Hada Amar Rava, but then Rava changed his mind. And he said, no, Rava and Hareyu Kemochama. No, actually, we should consider a famine to be exactly the same as war. That we can't necessarily, just because she says that he's dead, we can't necessarily assume that she knows it for a fact. It might be B'Dami. Why? B'Dami that she assumes. Why? Dahi da osis lakame de Rava, because you actually have a case where a woman came to Rava, Omrele, she says to him, Baili Mesperov, my husband died in a famine, and Rava had a feeling that she doesn't know for sure that he's dead, that she's assuming that he probably died. Omala, so Rava tries to draw her out, he says to her, Shaper Abdus, the Shavasnafshech. You know what? You did good by getting away from there to save yourself. What? What do you think? The little amount of grain that you would have been able to sift, that would have been enough to keep him alive? Obviously not. You have good reason to assume that he was probably about to die anyway, and therefore it's good that you got out of there in time before you yourself died of the hunger. One of the Kesef Mishnah brings a slightly different explanation. If I understood him correctly, Purta Denafisa, like he's like sifted flour, kind of like he's white there. You know, he's on the verge of dying. Yeah, I mean, you know, he wouldn't have lasted much longer. Amrele, and she says, it's true, you know that he wouldn't necessarily have died. Which means, in other words, what does this mean from this conversation? We see Shitaka didn't know he was dead. Rava drew her out over there, and it ended up, it ended up that she effectively admitted that she didn't actually see her husband die, she just assumed that he was dead. So Rava, when she said, my husband died, Rava wasn't sure. He had a feeling that she's not saying based on actual evidence. She's just saying bit of dummy based on an assumption, or he wasn't sure, or whatever. So he tried to draw her out. So he says to her, you know what? It's good you got away in time. I mean, it's not like he was going to last much longer anyway. And she says it's true. He wouldn't have lasted much longer, which effectively tells us, yeah, he shouldn't stick around to actually see him die. So therefore, Rava is saying, based on that story, I can see that yes, even in a case of a famine, you do have to be concerned that she left and assumed that he was dead and didn't actually wait around. Hada Amar Rava. Then Rava says, actually, Ravin Griya Mimochama. Actually, in a way, a case of famine is even worse. We believe her in that case even less than we do as far as warfare. But because during wartime, if she says he died in the war, we don't believe her because maybe she's just assuming that he's missing in action, so therefore he's probably dead. But if she were to say, yes, it was wartime, but he died on his bed, we would believe her. But when it comes to a famine, we don't believe her unless she actually says he died and I buried him. The difference is, in other words, so various mepharshim talk about. So what's the difference? One difference is that when it comes to a famine, she's saying even if she says he died on his bed, yeah, well, that's people die of famine in their beds. So not necessarily is it any stronger than saying that he died of the hunger. Whereas in the case of warfare, there's a difference. She might say he's missing in action, and therefore I assume he's dead. But she's not going to go so far as to make up a whole new circumstance that he would have died in, that he died in his bed. So therefore that we can accept. The Rambam, by the way, just to finish off, the Rambam has an interesting shita on this, which is that during wartime, even if she says he died and I buried him, we don't believe her. And the Mephoshim have the Kesef Mishnah spends a couple of pages discussing the whole issue. Why not? If we're saying over here in a time of famine that we believe her if she says that she buried him, because to go so far as to say she buried him, that she won't do unless it's true. Why in the case of wartime not? So again, there's a few different answers. One of them being that in wartime everybody's confused, everybody's running around to get away that they don't get killed. In such a situation, who's going to bother actually burying? if she claims that she actually buried her husband, not necessarily, is she telling the truth? She may have fantasized the whole thing. Or one of the Mefarshim says that what may have happened, I think the Ritva says, she may indeed have buried somebody, but maybe it wasn't her husband. The bodies all over the place over there from that were killed in the war and in the crossfire and whatever. In the confusion, yeah, she buried somebody and she thought it was her husband, but really it's somebody else. Now, that we'll learn in the next page. Okay, yeah, there's that too. Yeah.
The dental records.
Yeah.